copyright Forum of Christian Leaders. The contents contained on this website are solely for your own individual, non-commercial, and informational use. Any other use is strictly prohibited without our express prior written consent. See the full copyright disclosure at focalonline.org.
The early Christian apologist Justin Martyr said about his discovery of the Christian faith. Someone came up to him along the seashore and told him about Jesus, told him about how he was the fulfillment of the greatest, these great prophets and so forth, that they predicted that he would come and do certain things and rest and be the savior of the world, and the Platonic philosophy that Justin Martyr was so familiar with. He found that this Christian faith was, he said, I found this philosophy of Christianity alone to be safe and profitable. Thus, and for this reason, I am a philosopher. Here he had been intrigued by Plato, and in fact found Plato to be very helpful as a gateway, as a pathway to understanding the significance of Jesus. And so he talked about the connection of Christianity and philosophy. The philosopher Brian Lefthow, who is at Rutgers University, had just been the from Oxford University, where he had been a professor. He says it was Christianity that brought me to philosophy. And that's a common story that we hear in, as you look at the history of thought in the West, many people being drawn to the robust life of the mind that the Christian faith affords. And of course, C.S. Lewis, who said, I believe in Christianity as I believe that the sun has risen, not only because I see it, but because by it I see everything else. So Lewis, who was actually trained in philosophy, applied for a position in philosophy at Oxford University, didn't get it, so oh well, had to do literature there. Not a bad fallback, and we are certainly blessed to have the benefit of Lewis's literary work that flowed from his time at Oxford and then Cambridge. Abraham Kuyper, declared that there is not one square inch of the whole domain of our human existence over which Christ, who is sovereign over all, does not cry, mine. The Christian faith, he maintained, is a total life system, which has implications for politics, science, art, and the academy. And for those of you who know of Abraham Kuyper, he was a theologian. He was very interested in philosophy. He was also a journalist. He was an educator, founding the Free University of Amsterdam. Also the Prime Minister of Holland in the first part of the 20th century. So really a Renaissance man. But he saw the implications of the Christian faith for the entire scope of knowledge. Everything under the lordship of Christ. And our mindset as Christians, all the more as academically minded ones, means to have the mind of Christ, as Paul said in Philippians 2:2, to take every thought captive to the obedience of Christ, 2 Corinthians 10:5, to set our minds on things above, Colossians 3:2, to gird up the loins of our minds for action, 1 Peter 1:13. Philosophy, literally the love of wisdom, isn't unaided human reason operating independently of God's empowering spirit. No. We are to undertake this task with the full measure of God's empowerment. Philosophy itself can be a tool under Christ's lordship used to help us to first detect and evaluate worldview assumptions in general, also to think more deeply and clearly about our own discipline, also to bring unity and coherence to the academic disciplines overall, and also to avoid succumbing to passing fads and ideologies. You may have heard of this fact value distinction. You know, people, you know, through in the 20th century, through logical positivism, came to believe that that facts can be known through, say, science, the empirical sciences, but values that really can't be understood through, you know, can't be known through science, so values are just merely subjective. There are, you know, of course, there's the sacred-secular dichotomy that people are often making, and of course, utterly false, given what we've seen with regard to Christ being Lord over all. The fad of scientism, that everything has to pass by the bar of science in order to be approved as knowledge. Of course, postmodernism, another fad in which fundamentally there is no universal truth, except the idea that there is no universal truth becomes that universal truth. That all knowledge is embedded. But how did we come to know that all knowledge is embedded unless we're able to somehow rise above and make a broad assessment of how things are working in the bigger picture? Multiculturalism, that there are no better or worse things across the cultures, that there's nothing to affirm that is greater than anything else. And otherwise, it's seen as snobbery. It's seen as a colonialism. It's seen as imperialism and so forth. And then there is reductionism, everything being reduced to what can be understood in physical or scientific terms. So again, these are the sorts of things, the fads that we come across and that the Christian faith is well prepared to address. Now, some Christian attitudes toward philosophy are, we can describe them as there's the philosophilic, that is, those who can appreciate philosophy, they like philosophy, but they may not be certain about the role of philosophy in the Christian life. Then there are the philosophobic, those who are fearful of philosophy, they're gun-shy about it. They might think that it's dangerous, or maybe at best that it's a waste of time. That it just is not worth your while to undertake that. And I've heard plenty of people tell me stories about how, my pastor said I shouldn't study philosophy because it's going to lead me away from the Christian faith and so forth. Well, as you look at the history of the Christian faith, that this is really a far cry from what we see happening in the great academies of Christendom. We actually see that there is a robust connection between philosophy and the Christian faith. And again, done rightly, philosophy has a wonderful role in supporting the task of the gospel and faith in Jesus Christ. So let's make a few comments here on the importance of philosophy in the academy. And we just heard from Daryl, quoting Francis Schaeffer, that thinking philosophically is a task that is inescapably human, that we cannot get away from doing philosophy. My professor, Stuart Hackett at Trinity Seminary, said everyone is a philosopher. The Christian philosopher Alvin Plantinga has said that philosophical reflection is not much different from just thinking hard. So just thinking hard, thinking deeply. Another person has summed up philosophy as being thinking about thinking. Well, philosophy focuses on the big questions. What are those big questions? Well, when you open up an Introduction to Philosophy textbook, it's going to cover, first of all, metaphysics. What is really real? Is everything just material? Is there a spiritual realm? What about knowledge, epistemology? How can we, can we know things? Can we trust the deliverances of our own minds, our cognitive faculties? Are laws of logic binding? Are they universal, or are they just kind of maybe something Western and not Eastern? And those are the sorts of questions that will come up. And then there is the aspect of axiology or ethics, value, beauty, right and wrong, duty and virtue. Again, everyone will take a stance on these things. Everyone will have a metaphysic. Everyone will have an epistemology. Everyone will have an ethic. They may not think about it very deeply, but they're going to take a stance on certain things. The atheist philosopher Bertrand Russell said that behind every philosophy is a concealed metaphysic. You know, it's like the foundations of a house. You know, you just look and you see the house, but what is it built on? You know, is it built on something faulty or and cracked, or is it built on something stable and sound? Well, we all have a view on what is ultimately real. Now, we all, again, have a view on knowledge and value and virtue. And furthermore, it's not just something that is intellectual. A worldview or philosophy of life is going to be fundamentally a heart commitment. It is something more deeply embedded. The philosopher J.G. Fichte noted that our philosophies or worldviews are not what he called a dead piece of furniture. But rather, these are animated by our soul. They are deeply personal. They're bound up with who we are at our core. And so when we're speaking to people about their worldviews, remember that there are fundamental heart commitments that hold that worldview together and that are not simply going to be shaken by mere intellectual tweaking. Sometimes it's a matter of confronting the will of a person and challenging the person to rethink that kind of an assessment of where they stand in terms of how they view the world. Engaging the will is going to be very important for us as we think through our philosophy of life and others' philosophies of life. So, everyone is a philosopher. Also, secondly, thinking philosophically has biblical precedent. God, of course, is the creator of the human mind and the source of rationality. In Isaiah 1:18, it says, God is telling his people, come, let us reason together. And so we shouldn't be surprised to find the scriptures actually supporting the task of philosophy. Think of the book of Job. It is a very philosophical book, discussing evil, divine hiddenness, human responsibility, fatalism, and so forth. Those sorts of things that come up in philosophical discussion. The book of Ecclesiastes, again, continues some of those discussions of fatalism, hedonism, the pursuit of raw pleasure, nihilism, a philosophy of meaninglessness, human nature, mortality, meaning, and purpose. Again, common topics in a philosophy class. And, of course, concluding, there are two voices in Ecclesiastes, the one more skeptical, cynical voice, and then the other voice, not the preacher, but commenting on the preacher, saying that though the preacher was tweaking people and provoking people, the sum of the matter is this, to fear God and to keep his commandments, because God is going to bring everything to light, whether it be good or evil. God is going to call us into account. Jesus could rightly be called a philosopher. A friend of mine, Doug Grotius, writing the book, that's for my Dutch friends here, writing a book on Jesus as a philosopher, talking about how he spoke with intelligence and profundity about being, or metaphysics, about knowledge, about value. That Jesus was one who indeed embodied divine wisdom. The Apostle Paul, according to N.T. Wright, would have been considered a philosopher in the Mediterranean world. A lot of people think, oh, that's just religious stuff. No, the first century, Paul would have been a philosopher. In fact, he is viewed by Luke when he comes to Athens in Acts 17. Luke views Paul as a Christian Socrates. The same language that is used in Plato's dialogues, Plato's Apology and talking about the death of Socrates, talks about how Paul is dialoguing in the agora, in the marketplace. He is also presenting a new teaching, just like Socrates was, that he is also speaking about foreign deities. And of course, the Athenians heard, oh, there's this Jesus deity, and there's this, maybe this female consort, Anastasis, resurrection. Because Paul was talking about Jesus and the resurrection. And so Paul was here coming as this Christian Socrates to Athens. Paul himself was from Tarsus, the center of philosophy in his day. Probably, there are three leading centers in the Mediterranean world. Of course, there was Alexandria, there was Rome, and there was Athens. Here you have these centers, these hubs, and so and then you have Tarsus, which is this, it's not Rome. It's Tarsus. Paul said he's from no mean or insignificant city. So Tarsus, Athens, and Alexandria. And so Paul was probably, according to Ben Witherington, New Testament scholar, probably in the top 1-2% of the intellectual elite of his day. That was Paul, of robust intellect. And he was quoting Stoics in his speech in Athens. Also, some people will be critical of philosophy, however. They'll say philosophy is just, is rejected by the scriptures. After all, look at Colossians 2:8. Paul says, beware of philosophy. But Paul goes on to say, empty deception and the tradition of men, according to the elementary principles of this world. Sure, philosophy detached from Christ is, again, going to be missing the big picture. It's not going to put everything together. But philosophy that is focused on Christ, that is where sound wisdom is to be found. So Paul isn't denouncing philosophy, but human-based thinking. That's what he's denouncing in Colossians 2. What about, Paul? Isn't he denouncing, wisdom and earthly wisdom in 1 Corinthians chapter 1? Paul is saying, he's not denouncing philosophy. He's actually not denouncing rationality. He is denouncing human pride, that this is the problem, for the Jew and the Gentile alike. The cross of Christ is a stumbling block for them. But Paul isn't saying, therefore, we should just be irrational and just embrace what is foolishness to everything else. No, Paul is saying that through, if we're going to embrace Christ, it is going to mean a self-humbling. It's not going to mean throwing our minds out. And so Paul is very clear on this. In fact, a lot of people will quote from 1 Corinthians 1 and 2 as though we should not take an interest in philosophy. The gospel is foolishness to those who are perishing, that the natural man doesn't understand the things of the Spirit of Christ and so forth. Well, I tell people, keep reading. Read to the end of 1 Corinthians, and you'll see in chapter 15 that Paul actually gives reasons for believing in the objectivity of the bodily resurrection of Jesus, that Jesus was raised from the dead, and that there were these eyewitnesses who saw him alive after his death, and that this was an early testimony from the Jerusalem church. So again, Paul is not speaking against any sort of rationality, but against pride. Some people say, well, what about Thomas? Doesn't Jesus tell Thomas, after he's encouraged him to touch him and so forth, blessed are those who have not seen and yet still believe? Well, I tell people, read the next verses, the very next verses. What does it say there? It says Jesus performed many other signs that were not written in this book, but these signs, miracles, have been written so that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that by believing you might have life through his name. Notice the connection. There is evidence. There is, there is something to look to, public signs available for people to scrutinize, and that these can provoke or influence belief. In fact, as you keep reading in what John wrote in 1 John 1:1, John talks about that which we have heard and seen and looked at and touched with our hands. This we proclaim to you concerning the word of life. John's not renouncing any sort of objectivity. No, he's saying, no, we saw him, we handled him, we touched him. And so he is affirming this as a faithful witness to the resurrected Jesus. So the Bible is full of signs and wonders that strongly encourage faith, even if they don't coerce faith. So that's a little bit more about philosophy and scripture. Also, thinking philosophically can strengthen our theology. As we said, Alvin Plantinga, we're talking about philosophy as being not much different from just thinking hard. And traditionally, philosophy has been the handmaiden to theology, that it has a ministerial or assisting role. And so some people think, philosophy, therefore, it's not really relevant. No, it's actually of great help. It's not diminishing the role of philosophy. It's actually elevating the role of philosophy, that it has a place within the kingdom of God. Philosophy can be of great service for helping us to grasp and clarify Christian doctrine. Again, not an attempt to remove mystery and awe, but rather philosophy can enhance the worship of God as we worship in spirit and in truth, pointing to Christ as the wisdom from God. When it comes to theology, Alistair McGrath said that it's basically discourse about God, or if we want to apply what we just said in philosophy, that theology is simply thinking hard about God. And so people like Augustine and Anselm and Aquinas use philosophical rigor to assist in their theologizing. Today in philosophy of religion, there are those who have been trained in philosophy. They're called philosophical theologians or analytic theologians who have made a remarkable contribution to systematic theology by a more robust, intellectually rigorous, and conceptually precise understanding of doctrines like the Trinity and the Incarnation and original sin and divine foreknowledge and human freedom. You know, all of these amazing, rich discussions have been enhanced by philosophy. Theology is also can be expressed in philosophical terms, and traditionally has been. Princeton University's Diogenes Allen regularly taught his theology students about the place of philosophy in their discipline. And this is what he writes in his book, Philosophy for Understanding Theology. He said, "Everyone needs to know some philosophy in order to understand the major doctrines of Christianity or to read a great theologian intelligently. Philosophical knowledge enables one to appreciate more deeply the meaning of virtually every major doctrinal formulation and every major theologian." So if you think, don't give me that philosophy stuff, just give me theology. Well, if you want to do theology, you're going to have to do some philosophy. Doesn't mean that you have to become an expert, and the more expert you are, great, wonderful. But it's good to know something about that. And I think that the book by Diogenes Allen, Philosophy for Understanding Theology, is a good place to start. But, you know, think about the doctrine of the Trinity. Philosophical terms like substance, being, and essence. Some people say, oh, that's just importing Greek philosophy into Christian theology. Well, no, what it's doing is it's actually using these known concepts that actually express biblical truth, but not distorting it. It's just using a different category to categorize, to conceptualize, to clarify what is meant. And so this can be very, very useful as we're discussing things that are not as precisely articulated in Scripture. We get the bigger picture. We see concepts and doctrines embedded in narratives and so forth. And so we need to draw those out and say, how does this all fit together? And that's the task of systematic theology. So if you want to read Augustine's Confessions, it's good to know something about Neoplatonism, for example. If you want to read about Aquinas, you want to know something about Aristotle. Now, thinking philosophically also will better enable us to examine others' assumptions as well as our own. And we've already touched on this a little bit, but let me say a little bit more about this. Again, I had referred to N.T. Wright, but this is a quotation from him about worldviews being like foundations of a house. He said, "They are vital, but invisible. They are that through which, not at which, a society or an individual normally looks, not bits of reality that offer themselves for organization." The philosopher Alfred North Whitehead said that when you're criticizing the philosophy of an era, he says, "Do not chiefly direct your attention to those intellectual positions which its exponents feel it necessary to defend. There will be some fundamental assumptions which adherents of all the variant systems within each epoch or era unconsciously presuppose. Such assumptions appear so obvious that people do not know what they are assuming because no other way of putting things has ever occurred to them." And so that's where we can come in and help to push a bit more, firmly back on, well, what led you to that kind of an assumption? Charles Tulliver, a philosopher of religion, has said that philosophy enables us to see the world often through another person's eyes, and sometimes make adjustments to our own worldview in the process. Let me give an example of how this might look when it comes to examining assumptions. Let's take, for example, Stephen Hawking, the late Lucasian chair of mathematics, the chair that Isaac Newton held at Cambridge. And he wrote in a recent book that that philosophy is dead, and that really physics must rescue us. Another thinker we can add, is Richard Lewontin at Harvard University, a biologist, who said we have to assume materialism in order to do science. You see, both of these are simply expressions of, not science, but actually scientism. That is, it's arbitrary for one thing to say that that science alone gives us the answers. Why not other areas? And it's also self-contradictory to say that science alone can give us knowledge, because how do you know that science alone can give you knowledge? It wasn't through science, was it? No, you can't scientifically prove that all knowledge has to come through science. Again, that is a philosophical assumption rather than conclusions of scientific research and so forth. So they are taking, Stephen Hawking and so forth, they're taking a philosophical stance rather than a scientific one. In fact, science used to be called natural philosophy. And that's why it reinforces the point that C.S. Lewis made, that good philosophy must exist, if for no other reason, because bad philosophy needs to be answered. And so you certainly see that epitomized here. But take also another example of a rising trend called transhumanism, which utilizes technology to improve human function, mental capacity, and even longevity. They're called cyborgs. And so this question, it really attempts to mimic a Christian vision, a pursuit of a this-worldly utopia, to pursue perfection and immortality. Now, while certain improvements to life through technology can be beneficial, like overcoming the effects of Parkinson's disease or Alzheimer's disease and so forth, transhumanism takes this naive, optimistic view of the human condition and technology, that technological advancement means progress in all cases. It assumes that there's nothing flawed about the human condition. But that is a pernicious assumption. Imagine a person like Hitler or Stalin or some child molester who is able to live forever but engage in cruelty and wickedness perpetually. Also, contrary to transhumanism, technological components add nothing to human value. But yet, what this transhumanism suggests, is that there is this kind of elite class of humans that are better than others who don't have those components, that they have greater worth, greater dignity. And so transhumanism threatens to create this elite class and view others as inherently inferior to them because they don't have that technology. But again, what does technology add to our worth or value? Absolutely nothing. But yet these are the sorts of naive assumptions that people will just go with without fundamentally challenging those in their minds. Thinking philosophically also means that we keep the big questions of life and meaning in mind. Everyone's worldview is going to take a position with regard to metaphysics, with regard to realism and anti-realism, with regard to anthropology. What is human nature like? With regard to knowledge, with regard to ethics and morality, with regard to history, does history have a purpose or meaning? Does that have a direction to it? And what does death signify? Does death signify the end of all existence or not? And then we can also talk about all of these questions are fundamental to one's worldview. And it's helpful to kind of unpack these in our own minds as well as, as we're talking to other people. And so, again, everyone's worldview is going to take a position on these things. And so, so as we think worldviewishly, as we think philosophically, we're going to keep these big questions in mind. Seventh, thinking philosophically enables the Christian to offer a coherent explanation of the universe and of human experience. The Christian faith offers, from a philosophical point of view, the greatest explanatory power for, you know, for how the universe came to being, how it came to be so finely tuned, how human beings came to have dignity and worth, how consciousness could emerge, how beauty could exist, how rationality could come about, free will and human dignity and so forth. And even we can say the problem of evil. Again, the problem of evil assumes that there is a standard that is being violated, a design plan, a way things ought to be from which evil is a deviation. You see, if naturalism is true, if nature is all that there is, then there is no way things ought to be. Things just are. You see, the naturalist has two problems to deal with. The problem of evil, everyone has to deal with the problem of evil, but also the problem of goodness, or the design plan. You know, where is the standard by which we judge something to be evil in the first place? Let me just close with this, and then we'll take some time for questions. But finally, thinking philosophically and Christianly helps bring unity and clarity to the academic disciplines. Augustine, and then later echoed by the Wheaton philosopher Arthur Holmes, said, "All truth is God's truth, and we can affirm the truth wherever it is to be found." Now, there's a great danger in the academy of specialization and fragmentation that comes because of that specialization in these academic disciplines. And, you know, but the Christian faith offers a unification of those disciplines. So often those disciplines are not speaking to each other, but the Christian faith has the capacity to bring together these, and show how they all fit together under the lordship of Jesus Christ. So there's a great danger of thinking atomistically, as though my discipline is the only discipline worth looking at, rather than seeing how it all fits together and ties in with the other disciplines. And I think it's great when Christian philosophers and sociologists and psychologists and so forth get together and see how their disciplines fit together, in a Christ glorifying way. We need to understand also that philosophy is a tool within our own particular discipline. You see, philosophy isn't a worldview. Some people think philosophy is like atheism or something like that. No, it's not a worldview. We can distinguish between philosophy as a discipline and a philosophy that a person has. But philosophy is going to involve learning how to think, clarifying concepts, formulating arguments, justifying positions, integrating ideas into a coherent worldview. And this is what Socrates did. He saw himself as a gadfly, as well as a midwife. He was a gadfly he wanted to rouse the large and well-bred horse Athens that had grown sluggish and wanted to make it a better place through asking provocative questions and issuing stinging rebukes. And also as a midwife, he wanted to help others to give birth to thoughtfully crafted ideas. And so philosophy can be a tool toward that end. It's also helpful to distinguish between first order and second order disciplines. Consider history, which is a first order discipline. That is, we study events, for example, that gave rise to, say, the Reformation or the Enlightenment. So when we look at that, that's what we call the first order discipline. But there's a second order discipline that is known as the history, or the philosophy of history. That philosophy can actually assist the historian, using philosophy as a tool to analyze and clarify and systematize concepts and questions and practices and assumptions used in the historian's work. The philosopher Thomas Nagel shows how philosophy can serve as a tool for a variety of disciplines and facets of life. This is what he says. He says, "The main concern of philosophy is to question and understand very common ideas that all of us use every day without thinking about them. The historian asks about what happened in time past, but the philosopher will ask about whether history itself has meaning or what time is. Math teachers instruct their students about numbers, but the philosopher asks, what is a number? Are numbers real? A physicist will study atoms and their activity, whereas the philosopher will ask whether a mind-independent reality exists and what is the nature of causality. A moviegoer might wonder about whether slipping into a theater without paying is morally permissible, but the philosopher will ask, what makes an act right or wrong? What is the basis of morality? We couldn't get along in life without taking the ideas of time, number, knowledge, language, right and wrong for granted most of the time. But in philosophy, we investigate those things themselves." Indeed, when we look at the various disciplines, it's hard to find a discipline that doesn't have a philosophy of before that particular discipline. Psychology, philosophy of sociology, philosophy of history, philosophy of education. Thomas Morris, somebody who taught philosophy at Notre Dame, wrote a book for the business community, If Aristotle Ran General Motors. There's also philosophy of film. There are books on the philosophy of The Matrix, or even The Simpsons, or superheroes, and so forth. Finally, we want to just say something about how philosophy means that we take our discipline and make it better. Well, speaking of philosophy itself, through the work of Christian philosophers like Alvin Plantinga and William Alston, we have seen really a burgeoning of Christian philosophy. The founding of the Society of Christian Philosophers, the growth of the Evangelical Philosophical Society and others. There's just been an upsurge of this interest in philosophy of religion in the latter part of the 20th century and into the 21st century. I mean, just there's an explosion of this, and it's very, very exciting. Think of sociology that has been impacted by the work of Christian scholars in the field. Christian Smith at University of Notre Dame, Rodney Stark and Robert Woodbury at Baylor University, and how looking at things from a Christian point of view can actually help to reshape the discipline, that these categories of faith and so forth really make a difference within the discipline of sociology. I'll just give an example. I mean, Robert Woodbury talked about the influence of Protestantism making an impact throughout the world, bringing about moral reform, literacy, education, and so forth. Where you see Protestantism, there you will see more stable democracies. There you will see higher literacy rates, lower corruption rates, lower infant mortality rates, and so forth. You see that the ideals of the Protestant Reformation, of the priesthood of all believers. Think of democracy. You see the right of everyone to have the Bible in his own tongue. Think of literacy. Think of public education, and so forth. And of course the glorification of any vocation that is carried out to the glory of God. That these are the sorts of things that have really transformed Western culture. And so Robert Woodbury is one who has highlighted this. So again, I can talk about how we can, through philosophy, we can talk about how, we can see that ideas have consequences, that bad philosophy can lead, will lead to, Paul Johnson said that through the philosophy, the idols of powerful ideologies, he said over 100 million were killed or starved to death in the 20th century through these flawed philosophies. And, Paul Johnson's a marvelous historian. But again, there is a connection between ideas and how those ideas are lived out. You think of in terms of roots, shoots, and fruits. So you think of the roots as being the voices that we listen to, Karl Marx, Krishna. Think of other ideologies. There starts with this voice speaking with authority. Which voice are we going to listen to? And that voice is also going to give rise to a worldview. Those are the shoots. But then that worldview is also going to produce certain fruits. And so we need to see that there is this organic connection. It's not as though those are detached. And also we should add this, that when we see a worldview like naturalism, where it's molecules in motion, where it's determinism and so forth, how does that lead to value? How does that lead to consciousness? How does that lead to rationality? Well, basically what ends up, they're borrowing from another worldview like theism in order to get to that outcome. Because they can't live within the constraints of their own philosophy. And so it's important when there's something that, when something seems to be out of sync with their starting points, then we say, well, what's going on here? And so we can push back and say, I think you're borrowing from another worldview here. Also, philosophy can help us to, of course, expand our horizons. And we can, as we study philosophy, we can start thinking about a range of other topics and disciplines and see, law, economics, politics, history, theology, and science, and see how all of these, we can bring all of these things together. So having a little bit of exposure to philosophy can really help us to work outward to other disciplines, to examine assumptions within those disciplines and so forth. Anyway, those are just a few reflections that I have. I know I've gone a little bit over, but I wanted to take the remainder of the time that we have here for any questions or comments that you might have. So. Thank you.